You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. Today on the show, we have Andrew Jasko. He is a psychotherapist and a comparative religion scholar, the founder of Life After Dogma, and a survivor of high-control evangelical and Pentecostal Christianity. He was raised as the son of a minister in a Pentecostal cult, and he trained for full-time ministry, serving as a missionary in India, and worked as a minister before a profound deconversion and a recovery from religious trauma. His insider background deeply informs both his clinical work and academic study of high-control religion. He has a Master's of Divinity and a Master's of Philosophy. He has an MA. He has so many different degrees. And I love that he is going to be joining the field of psychotherapy. And it will be exciting to have him here as a fellow licensed professional. He is a religious trauma and cult specialist. And it is so good to be able to have him on the show. He brings together survivor insight, research, and trauma-informed psychotherapy to make things clear and to address the mechanisms of harm in coercive systems. And today, he brings a special subject with him, and we've already scheduled his next interview with us, where he's going to switch gears and we're going to talk about a whole other subject. It's great to talk to him about so many things. He is a past guest on the show, and it's so wonderful to have him back. Here's Andrew now. It is exciting to have my colleague, Andrew Jasko, back on the show. It's been many years. I know that we talked sometime around the COVID era, where everything was done on Zoom, and we're all still sort of adjusting to that reality. Now it's become much more commonplace and very convenient to be able to do it this way, although I look forward to being able to hopefully see you at upcoming conferences. I would love for you to take a moment to introduce yourself. There's some people who are going to remember you from last time, other people who are listening to you for the first time. So please let our listeners know a little bit about you, and then we'll start talking.
Thank you so much for having me, Rachel. It's great to be back. I am an associate marriage and family therapist, and I specialize in religious trauma, spiritual abuse, and cult recovery. I grew up in evangelical and Pentecostal Christianity as the son of a minister. So my parents took me straight from the hospital to the church altar to devote me to a life of service to God. And that's what I did. They had a prophecy before I was born that I was going to be like a great man of God. And so I was always trying to live up to that. And I really took it very, very seriously. I went to church multiple times a week, often four or five times a week. I've read the Bible probably a couple hundred times, have two Bible degrees, went to seminary. I did the whole thing, was really, really radically devoted and totally believed that my religion was reality, that it just described reality. It was kind of the ocean that I swam in, so to speak. As I was really totally devoted to this, I was going to become a missionary to India to convert Hindus and Muslims to Christianity and bring about the second coming of Jesus, because evangelical Christianity is an apocalyptic religion, has an emphasis on the end times, and teaches that believers are to evangelize the world and make converts in every ethno-linguistic people group. And then once that happens, once the kingdom of God or the religious system or dominion is spread to the world, then Jesus comes back, slaughters the evildoers, i.e. people who don't believe in the religion. Everyone lives happily ever after, except most people who go to hell. But so, no big deal, right? I mean, but I was totally invested in this. But at the same time, I was really suffering tremendously psychologically. I had a lot of low self-esteem because I believed I was a sinner, that I wasn't good enough, that no matter what I did, I couldn't be enough. I wasn't enough, kind of had this shame identity. I had a chronic anxiety and fear about judgment in hell. I was taught to police my thoughts and search for any unsanctioned or sinful thought, and a lot of sexual repression because we were taught that even sexual fantasy was sinful and could lead us to hell. Realizing I had these issues caused me to seek mental health care. And as I was getting therapy, I started to connect the dots and realize that my religious beliefs were causing me psychological trauma. That led me to question and come out of it. And then I became an atheist and wanted nothing to do with spirituality or religion whatsoever. But as that process was happening, I lost my community, my career, my whole identity, my belief system, everything all at once. It was just this massive existential crisis, massive identity crisis, and a massive loss in so many different ways. It was really confusing, really disorienting. And I just worked on rebuilding my life and my career and ended up finding a lot of healing and transformation through different healing practices like meditation, psychedelic medicines in professionally facilitated containers. And so I started having so-called mystical experiences or expanded states of consciousness really for the first time. I really wanted to understand these experiences and understand more about consciousness and transformation. So I ended up getting a master's in counseling degree and working as a therapist and then studying Indian contemplative traditions, such as Hindu and Buddhist philosophies and psychologies over at Oxford in the UK. So now I'm a writer and speaker and specialize in supporting people making a similar transition.
I sometimes joke when people have done so much and I want to say, oh, that's it? Really? You couldn't have done more already in your young years? There is something very impressive about all of your studies and all that you've done. I think it's also incredible to hear you speak about this conflict, this idea of being so devoted to something, but so miserable simultaneously, needing to get some help, needing to understand that. It reminds me of what a lot of people say when they have been born and raised in something that is an intense tradition, where they've been made to feel superior to the people around them, but they feel quite inferior internally, that they are failing, that they are not as perfect as they're supposed to be, that any thought they have is somehow worthy of judgment if it's not in line with the things they're supposed to be thinking about. In fact, any thought that's a very human thought is somehow a failing, which is a very, very difficult way to live and also becomes excruciating. And some people choose not to live because of this dichotomy and this intensity of internal conflict. I'm so glad that you reached out for help. And it sounds like it helped you feel supported, but also helped you have a sense that there was something happening within the system itself, not that there was something wrong with you, but there was something happening within that system that was causing you to feel this way. Is that what was clarifying for you in that therapeutic process?
100%. And what you're talking about characterizes narcissistic abuse. And I see evangelical Christianity as being based on a system of narcissistic control and manipulation, with God, who often appears as a narcissistic deity who's really obsessed with his own grandiose self-image and his own glory above all else. So in this system, there's a lot of devaluation and idealization. Devaluation and idealization characterize narcissistic abuse, where people with narcissistic personalities kind of go between a feeling grandiose and inferior, and they tend to idealize or devalue other people. So in this religion, adherents are devalued. They're told that they're wretched, that they're sinners. And you hear people singing songs in church services, almost getting off to shame, like, woe is me, I'm a terrible sinner, I'm a wretch, there's nothing good about me. There's this breaking down of the self, of self-worth and of the identity. And then they're simultaneously idealized. You're this royal priesthood, the chosen people of God, a holy nation, set apart like a narcissistic lover. I love you unconditionally, but I'll burn you with fire in hell forever if you leave me. It's this oscillation between this superiority and inferiority that really characterizes this kind of abuse and keeps people hooked. It's really confusing being in that. And people are taught that to give God all the glory for everything, that anything good that happens to you is because of God, and anything bad that happens to you is because of you. So it's really hard to see that when you're in the religion. If you're having issues or having problems, you tend to interpret it as, this is my shortcoming, I don't have enough faith, I'm sinful. It's really hard to see, like, maybe there's something wrong with the religion, plus all the fear of hell and judgment comes along with that. So I think there were cracks in my worldview a long time before I came out. And I think this is the case with a lot of people. Like, a lot of people will have intellectual issues or difficulties with the patriarchy and rejection of homosexuality or just some of the teachings, but you kind of have to make it work and you're taught to make it work. It's hard to see, you know, wait a second, this isn't a me problem. This is a systemic problem.
This isn't a me problem. And that is supremely difficult, I think, also when you are a child, because it always feels like it's a me problem. They tell you as a therapist, when you're working with a family that's going through a divorce, you need to reassure the kids that it's not because of them. And I remember being confused about that when I was learning that in school. And I thought, well, why would the kids think it's because of them? And sometimes parents who are cruel will say it's because of you, but children will absorb the sense of responsibility and guilt, and what does this mean about them, and are they the problem here, or are they problematic here, way too soon and way too often. And so it's already built in that you're going to be carrying that around. And so to have that reinforced by an outside source, that yes, it is you. You are the problem. You do need to be thinking in a more pure way. You need to be acting in a more pure way, whatever that means, you know, sort of holding kids up to perfection, which a lot of people born and raised in cultic systems and in fundamentalist systems have a very hard time getting past, because it's like this finish line when you get to succeed and win the race, but it keeps getting shifted. Like, you're not perfect enough. You're not there yet. And just constantly feeling judged and less than, and like you can't achieve what you're supposed to achieve because it's not possible to achieve it. And the leaders don't hold themselves up to that standard too, which you also then see in front of you. Very confusing picture.
Exactly. And in fact, there's a core doctrine, the doctrine of original sin, or doctrines of human sinfulness in evangelical Christianity, which, I mean, there's a verse in the Bible, it says, "Surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me, were by nature deserving of wrath," is another verse. This is so contrary to human instinct. I mean, what mother looks at her newborn child and says, "Look at this wretched, evil thing"? But that's exactly what's being taught here. I remember some of my earliest memories when I was a young child, like 5 years old. I was obsessively confessing my sins before I fell asleep because I was terrified that I might forget to confess some sins, lose consciousness, and wake up in hell. Because this is what was taught. There are all these evangelists, and almost on every Sunday, just preaching you might lose your salvation if you fall into sin or into the temptation. You need to confess and get right with God. So there are these various ways in which your salvation or standing with God or safety is reinforced and then taken away at the same time. So it creates this pervasive sense of instability and insecurity. You never quite know whether you're safe. Some churches will teach that you can't know whether you're saved to begin with, so you might not be predestined or elect, and you might just kind of be faking it and not know it, or that you can just lose your standing with God and fall into sin or something. So just as a little child, you know, I had this terrifying fear of hell that is just being indoctrinated over and over again. We're shown these terrifying, vivid images of burning in hell, and it's just really baked in at a young age. So one of the biggest issues that I work with people is hell PTSD. Often when they're leaving or when they've left, these obsessive thoughts about hell and fear, what if I'm wrong, kind of a thing. And so working through that, it can be a major trauma.
Oh, a major trauma. I think there are so many people who need to be reassured that they're going to be okay, that they're going to be safe. They're going to be able to feel safer than when they were in an organization that was making them constantly fearful. But you can see when you're trying to convince people of that, they don't necessarily believe you. They have to sort of experience it. They have to go through a period of time, I think, when they're waiting for the lightning bolt, or they're waiting to be swallowed up in the fires of hell, and it doesn't happen, and it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. I think that repetition of being reminded that you are safe and that you're okay and that you are not punishable. Just your existence is not punishable. It needs to be something people experience. They might not just take your word for it.
That's a really common thing that I see with people, just especially as they're coming out of the group or the cult or whatever it is, but evangelicalism in particular, just because divine wrath and judgment is taught in such a severe and ultimate way. There's nothing worse that the human mind can conceive of than hell, really. It's literally the most awful idea conceivable. And so this is drilled into the psyche over often decades, is a really, I think, terrible thing and abusive thing. Not only that, but just being taught that you will suffer or you won't succeed or you won't be supported if you embrace your own path, that deviates from what this religious system, what this religious group is teaching. So a lot of times people will just be terrified that they're, I don't know, getting another job or engaging in their sexuality or doing something different, that they're going to be judged, that things are going to fall apart, that things aren't going to work out. You're right. It takes experience and noticing the exceptions. Actually, this worked out and nothing bad happens. This was all smoke and mirrors.
There is something also, and I don't know if you have been asked this question, where when you tell people that you are an atheist or agnostic, then sometimes the response that you might get is, well, then how do you know the difference between right and wrong? What stops you from doing something harmful or hurtful or doing something wrong? And so how do you respond to that, where people have been programmed, I think, trained to have this idea reinforced that without the structure around you, without the external locus of control, you are just going to live in a way that's a free-for-all?
And this is part of the whole teaching, that you need to be reliant on the religious institution and its ideology as mediated through its deity and beliefs and structure for pretty much everything. And also the core teaching that you can't trust yourself, because the way these systems work is they break down the sense of self. They break down your ability to really navigate your own life and experience, your trust in your critical thinking, in your body sense, in your intuition, in your own spiritual connection, in your own abilities, and outsource that to the religious or cult system. You're disempowered, your sense of self is broken down, and you rely on this kind of outsourced, externalized self, God or the religion or the ideology. They also explicitly teach that in evangelical and conservative forms of Christianity, the Bible is the inspired word of God, and biblicism is one of the core tenets of evangelicalism. Evangelical Christianity is a Protestant group, and it's kind of like the Pope was the major authority, along with Scripture and the church's interpretation of Scripture. Protestantism and evangelicalism kind of said, well, the Bible's the authority, but it's still an externalized authority. It's just one level closer to people. It's still this belief that this book is flawless and without error, and everything in it is true, that causes people to endorse a lot of harmful ancient ideologies that have been widely discredited in a lot of ways in all kinds of modern fields. Really, even having people look at the Bible, well, I mean, how do you choose which verses you pay attention to and don't here? There's genocide being taught in this passage. Do you believe that? Why not? Morality is something that we exercise and grow in. It's sort of an innate capacity, but also something that we learn about and study, just like everything else. So I really teach people simply to go with their own sensing, to think critically about that too. It's not like the Bible is this clear set of answers. It contains all kinds of different and contradictory teachings that people disagree about in vastly different ways anyway.
Very true. I think also about the idea of proselytization. But before we get to that, I was going to talk about something that I've talked about before on this podcast. Some people have heard me talk about how I like language. I like learning about languages. I like learning about the history of language and the origin of words. And it's just, I nerd out on a lot of books about words. And there are some people online who have been looking at the Bible linguistically and noticing mistranslations. So here it's taught to you as the word of God, but it's not a correct translation from the original language. So what is real? What is not? What's true? What is from God? What isn't? And some of the words that are mistranslated through people who study ancient texts and the languages connected to those ancient texts, so they have a sense of what that word meant and how it was then translated or mistranslated. Some of them are really from these fundamental stories that created these watershed moments and ways that we looked at so many things. And one example that I've talked a little bit about is this idea that the word given for Mary being a virgin, the word actually doesn't mean virgin, and it means young woman.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there was this idea that then you needed to be virginal and you had to save yourself before marriage, et cetera, et cetera. But that wasn't necessarily what the word meant. And another one that I remember hearing about, and it really impacted me because of just how different genders are treated and looked at within religious contexts, the idea of a woman coming from, or Eve being created from Adam's rib. The word was mistranslated, and it wasn't the word rib, sort of this kind of insignificant part of a man's body, but the word was side.
Yeah, it's side.
Right? So they were created side by side, which has this sense of equality. You just wonder if words had been given the meaning that they meant from the beginning. Not that everything in the Bible, even from its origin, is quote-unquote so kosher. Like, I don't know if I would really want to follow some of the things that it says in the Bible and how people were talked about, or even people with special needs, that they weren't able to be priests because there's something less than about them, on and on. But still, there were some things that really changed the course of how people were viewed and how people were supposed to live their lives and how it was okay to treat certain people because of it.
I say that if the Bible was inspired by God, then it was also inspired by Satan, so to speak, in that it contains some of humanity's darker or even worst ideologies and ideas about the divine and power and control. And we see bigotry, racism, homophobia, patriarchy, a lot of these really controlling tendencies endorsed by people in ancient times. This isn't exceptional to the Bible or Christianity, so I'm not even like just picking on just Christianity. You know, a lot of ancient cultures and documents functioned in these ways, and a lot of harmful ideologies have been normative in many human cultures for millennia. If we just take it as this divinely inspired book, people are kind of forced to swallow all of these ideas that if we encountered them, or if they encountered them anywhere else in society and culture, they might really be viewed as abusive or harmful, although they don't because they're forced to accept them as their worldview. I think it's really important for people who do want to use the Bible to be able to look at it critically, to be able to evaluate it and say, actually, this teaching is harmful and abusive, and we're not going to follow that. And something that gets downplayed a lot is that a lot of, I think, very fundamentalist and coercive doctrines are taught in the Bible. Evangelical and fundamentalist Christianity has a pretty valid claim that a lot of its teachings accurately represent the biblical tradition. I personally think that the early church, as is shown in the Bible, demonstrates a lot of high control and coercive and fundamentalist tendencies, and that dominant iterations of the religion have continued to do so. But I don't think that's the only way to interpret it. There's a lot of different teachings in the Bible, a lot of different possible interpretations. So people who want to continue using it or practicing some kind of Christianity, I just think it's important to be able to say, yeah, we disagree with this now, or we're going to evaluate this tradition from a different take.
I also see that, and I'll admit that it's a bias, that when people have this adherence to something in a black and white way, it feels psychologically more childlike. And there can be the sense that, just like how kids will dig their heels in if you try to argue with a point that they are sure about, as you kind of get older, many people will still need to hold on to that because it's their structure, or it's all they have, or it's the thing that makes them feel powerful or strong or come across as sure or superior, if that's why they're doing it. But that they say that a healthy mind is a flexible mind. And so when you can incorporate new data and go in a different direction, it doesn't mean that you're abandoning your conscience. You're not saying, oh, okay, now I'll do whatever I want to anyone and at any time. You're just saying, that's no longer something that works for me. I can't quite adhere to that. That doesn't speak to me, or it doesn't seem right. So I'm going to go in this other direction. That's probably why there are so many different denominations, that feels like more of an adult way of approaching it.
And I think you're right. All or nothing dichotomous thinking is developmentally less mature, that rigidity. But that's also the appeal for a lot of people of these kinds of groups, because it can be scary or terrifying to embrace our freedom and to have to think for ourselves and to wrestle with ambiguity and uncertainty. And so that rigidity and structure, this is the way things are, can be enormously comforting to a lot of people.
That's very true. You can kind of do a trust fall back into that. That feels good. So moving on to this idea of evangelical Christianity, I know that there are some traditions that don't proselytize, that don't go and want to convert. Judaism is one of them. Hinduism, I believe, also. Zoroastrianism, also. And probably some native traditions. This is our belief, and believe it or not, this is what we do, and this is how we think of things. And maybe some other traditions, too. But that there are, among other religions and certain parts of Christianity and Islam and others, where they want to make sure that other people believe the way they believe. And the way it plays out sometimes is very destructive and deadly. But I've also talked to people who said, I couldn't not do it. I felt like I was doing a disservice by not helping people see the light, come down this right path. It doesn't come from a destructive place, it feels, even though that can be the outcome. And it comes from this sort of pure need, as you've been told that this is your need and this is what you're supposed to do in life. So I wonder how it was offered to you as your mission, why it was important for you to then go and tell people how to believe.
Evangelical Christianity is definitely an evangelistic religion at the core. So there's definitions of evangelical Christianity that kind of vary, but they say that there's a high view of the authority of the Bible, personal conversion, what's commonly referred to as being born again, having your own conversion experience, the centrality of Jesus' atoning death, that Jesus died for your sins and for your salvation. And then active evangelism is the fourth pillar of evangelical Christianity. Evangelism and missionary work, so that this is necessary for your salvation, but also everyone else's. And that is the most critical thing for people, is that they convert to their religion, that this is the paramount need of humanity. And it's taught that way. And really, Christianity in the Bible is in a lot of ways a missionary movement. Paul, who was in many ways the founder of Christianity and its chief theologian. So Jesus gave all these teachings, and then the Apostle Paul came along and said, this is what this means. You know, this is what Jesus' death means, and this is what salvation is. This is the problem. So a lot of these things Jesus didn't really define. He kind of had, in a lot of ways, a Jewish view of things that he continued, but Paul really came along and wrote a significant portion of the New Testament. And Paul was a missionary. He went traveling the known world, starting churches among what they called the Gentiles, the non-Jews, and really spreading this religion. So it really taught that missionary work is central in a lot of Paul's teachings, the book of Acts, a lot of the Bible. The missionary movement, it kind of has roots. This is kind of a central thesis that I'm working on. I don't know if this is a good place. But this idea of God being a king and having the kingdom of God. In the Bible, God is styled after an ancient Near Eastern king. When a lot of ancient peoples thought of what their idea of authority might be, what maybe a divine creator might be, they looked, who was their highest authority? It was the king. And kings, what do? They judge, they go to war, they build empires, they conquer other nations, they expand their dominion, they promise boons and prosperity and love to loyal subjects, and wrath, judgment, death, and exile, and severe punishments and fear to people who dissent. So in the Bible, it says, fear is the beginning of wisdom. Fear the Lord. What is required of you but to fear your God? There's a heavy emphasis on fearing the king. And that made sense. So really, you get love from being obedient and submissive to the king. You're punished and vanquished if you disobey as an enemy. So Israel was founded, well, it became a kingdom. And actually, originally in the Bible, we see significant evidence that the Israelites used to be polytheistic. They used to worship multiple gods. So there's a god named El, who is kind of the stereotypical patriarchal old man in the sky. He was a Canaanite deity. And then there was Yahweh, who became Israel's exclusive deity. And there's a verse in Deuteronomy. There's several places. It says, when El, or Elion, translated as the Most High, apportioned the nations when he divided humankind, he gave Yahweh's portion, or the Lord's portion, was Jacob, was Israel. So he's the leader of this Canaanite pantheon, and he gives Yahweh to Israel. And El and Yahweh get combined in the Bible, but eventually, as the monarchy is consolidated, as centralized temple worship is consolidated, Yahweh becomes their chief deity, and he's this warrior deity. A lot of the Old Testament was written during times of oppression, domination by foreign nations, and so he kind of functions partly as a strongman deity, like this conquering deity consolidates the national identity against other foreign nations who are oppressing them. You see in the Bible, there's this war between gods. Yahweh seeks to vanquish the worship of Baal that's happening in Israel and foreign gods, and demands exclusive devotion. There's a penalty of death for worshiping other gods. It becomes this war of this God and his kingdom versus the other kingdoms. And in Christianity, this becomes this missionary campaign where it's not just other gods, it's kind of spiritualized into other religions and other spiritual ideologies. And there's this great commission. You're to go and make disciples of all nations and convert people from other religions, which are seen as hostile to God's kingdom. And they're given this mandate to enforce the kingdom. And then in the end times, Jesus comes back and literally slaughters in this massive Armageddon campaign everyone and people who get killed or sent to hell who are not part of their religion. So it's this same kind of graphic imagery, but literal violence is no longer endorsed, but there is an exclusivism and a fear-based exclusivism based on this conversionistic kingdom of God religious imperialism that's endorsed kind of from cover to cover.
It's so interesting. I mean, I remember learning about this growing up, going to Hebrew school, and learning about these different gods, which is not easy to learn about because, you know, we're so proud of being monotheistic. Like, I'm sorry, what? Even the word Baal, as it's translated from Hebrew, I think means Lord. There was all of this imagery. And I remember learning the Bible and reading about God being Melech HaOlam, which means King of the Universe. So then here come the Ten Commandments, which you shall have no other gods before me.
Exactly, the beginning of it.
And even with talking about God being in a bad mood, that Moses, after 40 years through the desert, all the sacrifice, all that he did, bringing down the Ten Commandments from Mount Sinai, he's not allowed in the Promised Land because he didn't trust God for a second and tried to get water from a stone or hit the stone and wasn't patient enough after 40 years, really, wasn't patient enough. Just wait a sec for God to provide, which I think is problematic because it's human nature to want to rush things when people are uncomfortable, when people are thirsty, when you're trying to provide for your people and to be punished. That always seemed unfair. I remember with kids learning that, like, hey, wait a minute. Moses did a lot of cool things if the story is as it was, but still, however you interpret the story, still, it feels like there was a lot of impatience for humans being human, and that didn't seem quite right.
Exactly. It's this very severe and punitive teaching. God is presented as simultaneously a romantic lover, or the lover of my soul. So people are taught to cultivate this really kind of sexualized and romanticized devotion to the deity and the system. simultaneously, he's this punishing lord who polices the thoughts and can be terrifying. So it's this really confusing mixture. And returning to what you said about evangelism, you're right. A lot of people suffer from guilt about evangelism. There's a passage in Ezekiel where the prophet is given this mandate to be a watchman and to warn people. And if he doesn't do it, their blood is on his head. So people are taught, if you don't talk to that stranger in the mall, if you don't go talk to your neighbor and share the gospel message with them, their blood is on your head. You're responsible for them going to hell forever. So it's a lot of guilt and pressure that are put on people, you know, who are often just want to live their lives and who might be a little introverted. You got to go and be this missionary and save everybody from hell. This is just an enormous amount of pressure.
Incredible. And I also think that people get kind of split off into two beings. And what I mean by that is that I've had conversations with people who went on missions to proselytize, and I've been curious about what drove them or why they did it. And sometimes it's a Mormon mission, and sometimes it's a Christian mission. It can be from a lot of different sources. But that they will talk about, you know, we were in Papua New Guinea, and the people there are so beautiful, and their traditions were so glorious, and they were so hospitable and warm and loving. With all of this sort of proper amount of deference and respect. And then, so we wanted to make sure that they believed the right way so they could be saved. And I thought, well, wait a sec. You were just talking about how their tradition is so rich and important, but it's suddenly not right and it's going to put them in danger and you know better. But there was like this, oh, and we have pictures of them and look at their tribal everything. And how gorgeous, and how they've existed this way for millennia, and now we want to change them. And I didn't quite get why they didn't hear how they sounded, how it seemed like such a switch, but it made sense, I think, to the people who really felt like they were there to save them, and this was the only way to do it, and that they were supposing they needed to be saved.
There's a lot of cognitive dissonance that people are forced to live with, just how much the worldview doesn't actually reflect reality, but they have to make it make sense somehow because their safety and survival and community and identity is contingent on that. How could people believe these things? Well, it's sort of not the right question. It's like, what's the cost of not believing it? We primarily function on layers of our being that aren't primarily cognitive or intellectual. That's sort of a luxury or an afterthought. We often use reason to justify getting our more basic needs met, like identity, belonging, community, all these things that these religions can really significantly provide, or that people can be connected to that in that way. So as far as missionary work, I mean, I was a missionary. I mean, my original career goal was to be a missionary to India, to convert Hindus and Muslims. So I went there on 6 missionary trips and was planning on becoming a lifelong missionary to India. That was my dream vocation. So it was really an interesting journey for me going there and falling in love with the culture and seeing a lot of beauty, but then having this agenda to covertly convert people. And I actually ended up coming full circle in a way, studying Indian traditions and benefiting from a lot of their teachings and practices. So this is another thing that people deal with a lot, is when they come out of these systems, having biases or stigmas against other practices or traditions, including secular psychology, because we were taught that psychology was influenced by atheist thinkers and that can lead you away. So it's kind of secular counseling was discouraged. We could only see Christian counselors, or we were put in that direction. Same thing with things like yoga, like people were in meditation, often taught that if you meditate, you might open your mind up to demonic control, and that yoga is associated with Hindu deities. And a lot of people have this fear, if they're looking to meditate or use mindfulness, that a demon's going to take me over. And that's a whole other fear mechanism that's used. If you're falling into sin, so to speak, or thinking deviant thoughts, or engaging in other healing practices, a demonic entity can hijack your mind and take you over. And you have this like schizophrenic, psychotic, like it's a terrible thing to teach young children.
Yes. So I'm wondering also just for a moment, if you can take us to one of your missionary trips to India, that experience of interacting with people and trying to teach them and trying to save them, if you remember a particular interaction that has stayed with you.
I went to Bible college, an evangelical Christian college called Wheaton College. My first missionary trip to India was in 2006, my sophomore year of college. We ended up staying at a hotel with a Hindu family and learning Hindi with the pretense of studying as cultural students and learning Hindi, then doing what they called relational evangelism, which is just making friends and sharing the gospel and trying to convert them. I just remember that family being so hospitable and kind and caring and listening to us share about the Bible and Jesus, and then just being kind of affirming and then sharing about their own beliefs and traditions. And they took us to a wedding, and I just had a really wonderful experience. And this is one of the things that can often lead to Hindu traditions being a little bit more resistant, is that there's a tendency in a lot of those traditions to be pluralistic or tolerant, so they can absorb other ideologies or other beliefs and keep practicing. So missionaries find that to be a struggle in converting them. They think they're making progress and people are saying, yes, what you're saying is true and Jesus is great, but like they're still going to go do their thing. Not always. I mean, there are a lot of people too who are converting to Christianity who are especially disenfranchised, because missionary organizations tend to use a kind of manipulative altruism targeting disenfranchised or impoverished people.
Right. I think about that with Jews. There's the whole movement, what they call Jew-boos, where there are Jewish Buddhists who are still Jewish and they just love Buddhist teachings and it speaks to them and it feels in line with a lot of Jewish teachings, and it's like combination.
Well, and this is one of the things that I appreciate about having studied Indian traditions and Sanskrit, that a lot of their traditions are actually fairly secular within so-called Hindu idea. So Hinduism is actually like a Western term that was imposed on.
Oh, interesting.
So it's kind of a construct in a lot of ways, but there are diverse ideologies that can get grouped together and have similarities. And there's something of a religion called Hinduism in some ways, but also there's a lot of diversity in ways in which that term doesn't quite fit. So there are atheistic schools of thought that get classified as Hindu that would consider themselves materialist or secular. Same thing in Buddhism. You could sit in a Dharma hall, in a lecture, in a satsang, and hear nothing that sounds remotely religious or spiritual, just philosophical and about resolving, reducing suffering. And there are really philosophies and psychologies in these traditions that are actually very secular. And that's why secular Buddhism exists. Like, there are a lot of atheists who value these practices too. So I think it's important to have that nuance, that a lot of people don't even see these traditions as spiritual necessarily.
That's so interesting. Wow, I'm learning a lot today. I'm wondering also, just as we talk about evangelical Christianity, what is something that we should know, or is there something that is concerning to you or that you think needs to be educated on when we talk about this issue?
One thing is that evangelical Christianity, it's estimated it has between 660 and 937 million people worldwide. On my estimates, somewhere 78 to 80 million in the U.S. So it's huge. It's one of the largest high-control groups in the world. And I think it has all the markers of a high-control group. It just doesn't tend to get thought of as such because it's so mainstream and so prominent. Practices vary and groups vary, but it does lend itself towards a high amount of control and coercion and manipulation. Such a huge amount of psychological fear drives the religious practice of so many hundreds of millions of people. I mean, this terrifying fear of hell is really a huge trauma. So there's a lot of fear, not only fear of hell, but fear of other people, fear of the influence of secular people, a kind of a paranoid us versus them mentality that I have to protect myself against outsiders and outside ideologies, either evangelize them and convert them or kind of separate and isolate out from them. There's just a lot of fear that's indoctrinated. Also, I find that with people who are recovering from it, one of the big issues is having a really severe inner critic or a voice inside your head that's saying you need to do better, this isn't enough, perfectionism, that this severe judgmental vision of God in a lot of ways, not entirely, but where you have to police your thoughts and emotions to root out sin, that that's something that people live with and have to recover from and develop a different relationship with themselves, a more compassionate and curious and kind self-relationship. Additionally, there's the fear, there's the shame, there's the kind of broken down self-relationship, which is a primary issue. Like, I don't matter, my desires don't matter, I can't trust myself. And the sexual repression is really big too. What's known as purity culture, a lot of people call it that, but having sexual thoughts and fantasies outside of a monogamous married relationship, which for a lot of people is most of their sexuality, before that or after that, or if you don't have that, or if you're not heterosexual, all kinds of different possibilities. Your sexuality is essentially a source of evil. It's this powerful urge as a teenager going through just having to fight this thing that it's going to throw you into hell or make you lose your salvation. And these teachings can be very severe and very damaging, and they're really prevalent.
Yeah, and I think about the cruelty around sexuality, that when you look at it from an evolutionary perspective, the fact that the urge is so great is for the survival of the species. And it's not a test, and it's not a sin, and it's not all these other things that you have to keep under control. It's to make sure that people are driven to procreate so that they don't die off, I think. So I think just to have this idea that your nature, your wiring, your human nature, your needs, your feelings all have the potential to send you right to hell, I wonder how you just make it through the day. How do you get through a conversation without thinking, oh no, I just had that thought, or I just had that urge, or I just had that memory? I don't know how you're not distracted all the time.
A lot of people, I would say, are. There's a kind of almost religious OCD that gets cultivated by these teachings. I mean, you're literally taught that your thoughts and emotions that often are just human, they're not bad, they're just human, could result in this horrifying torture. A lot of people do develop a kind of religious OCD or a lot of rumination, a lot of thought policing that they just think is normal. But some people aren't as deeply affected. Some people just kind of do their best and compartmentalize that stuff. But I would say even for people who are religious, who don't think it's an issue, who wouldn't say that they're very obsessive about sin, because there are also teachings that teach safety and security, they give you this mixture. They say you're okay and you're not okay at the same time. So people who are more like, I'm good, but generally when people leave this system, those fears kick in big time. They're operating unconsciously underneath the hood.
Exactly. So going back to these astronomical numbers that you were talking about before, just the amount of people who have this as their belief system and their mission, where do you see this going? I mean, I know I'm handing you this sort of crystal ball here, which may not be realistic to look at and to be able to know for sure that that's guiding us properly, but still, what is your concern about it, and what do you want people to be able to know or to watch out for?
These groups are evangelistically oriented, so they are growing, in especially more in certain parts of the world. There's been something of a decline in the U.S., but I don't know if it's a huge decline. I think that it's a difficult thing as socioeconomic conditions worsen in certain ways, or when they do, or when things like climate change become more of an issue, then these ideologies will become more compelling to a lot of people because authoritarian or high control ideologies contain authoritarian and really fascistic kinds of tendencies, like a king endorses this kind of system of control and domination. And the benefit is I'll give you power, I'll give you safety, I'll give you protection, I'll give you structure. That's what people benefit. People who feel powerless, people who feel I'm a wretched, hopeless sinner, I can't change my situation, I have a drug addiction, I don't have community, I need help. The religion, okay, we'll give you that. But you hand over your freedom at the same time. So this is what happens also in fascism. There's an appeal. There's a reason why people want these governments, because they promise strength, stability, power, hope, all these things. So I think that as conditions become worse or more unstable, these things can be more appealing. I see sort of competing trends. There's tribalistic mentalities or fundamentalistic ideologies that are on the rise among certain groups and will continue to probably grow when conditions are hard. At the same time, there are ideologies that are more globalistic, that are more, you could say, loving and compassionate and trauma-informed, that are also growing.
That's true, too. And you mentioned that this is growing in certain parts of the world. I'm wondering if you can tell us about some of those places or places that you know where this movement is growing or getting more of a stronghold.
They referred to it, at least in the tradition, as like the global south or more economically disadvantaged parts of the world or parts of the world that are transitioning in a lot of African countries, some Asian countries, China, Southern American countries, but not only those places, but definitely there's been growth there.
I wonder also just about what you think this does to people raised in this tradition. I mean, you had the benefit of seeking therapy and going into that field too, where you can continue to heal and to become aware of the impact that this has had on you and it has on other people. What have you noticed from people who are in it and now are adults? How have they been changed by this? What do you see?
It's something that has a really deep impact, especially if you were born into it or if you spend a significant amount of time in it. It's a total identity system for a lot of people, or functions in that way. They tell you how to live, how to spend your money, how to spend your time, what to do with your career often, how you're to relate sexually, what you're to think and believe. A lot of certain tendencies can linger, again, like a harsh inner critic, a lot of self-doubt, difficulty trusting yourself, looking to outside authorities or other people. Decision-making can be a challenge too. A lot of impulsive decision-making gets cultivated because often people are taught to listen for the voice of God when making decisions. So kind of sit and maybe through reading the Bible or sitting in prayer and then kind of what pops into your mind, God told me this. God spoke to me and said this. And so often I think there's a kind of impulsivity, like I want this thing, or maybe I should do this thing. Maybe I should get this job or marry this person or move to this place. Often people end up making rash decisions or related to finance too. There's a verse, seek first the kingdom of God and all his righteousness and his righteousness and all these things will be added unto you, that Jesus says, that gets taught. If you just trust God, everything will work out, your money, your career, and all that. So often, like, it's like, well, no, actually, you have to reclaiming agency, I think, is the most central thing, that I am the primary authority in my life, and also that it's good to be selfish in a way. I teach people to be selfish because often what they think of as being selfish is actually not selfish in the negative sense of the term. So the negative sense of the term is not taking other people's needs into account, not taking other people to account. So if you're selfish in a negative way, you're just doing things for yourself and disregarding other people. We don't want to do that. But what the religions and cults often do is they say, whenever you're taking care of yourself or prioritizing your own needs and desires, that's bad. So it's self-denial and self-abrogation and negation that gets taught, which is harmful because no one else is going to take care of us or assert our needs and desires and boundaries if we don't do it first. So it actually helps people know how to relate to us when we assert ourselves, when there's a healthy self-assertion. We say, this is my yes and this is my no. Okay, I know where you stand. And also we're taking care of ourselves. So really learning, and this is essentially reclaiming a sense of self, reclaiming agency, that it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to mess up. There's no cosmic tribunal. There's no catastrophe if I choose choice A or B and I can redirect. Accepting the ambiguities of life and accepting power and responsibility and self-advocacy and caring for yourself as a virtue, not a sin.
There is something that's activating about that. What is my part in this? I'm not going to sit back and wait or pray or hope. I'm going to act. I'm going to make things happen in my life. I'm going to have a thought about it that might be different and take that risk. There is this partnering. If you believe in God, I think, I guess I can only speak from my tradition, that in my tradition, there is a partnering with God, not a praying to and waiting and hoping, but a, okay, listen, God, will you have my back when I try to do the following? Let's do this together. Even celebrating Shabbat, there are these three blessings that you do over the bread or the challah, the candles, and the wine. And what I remember learning about that is really interesting to me, is that you don't do a blessing over wheat. You don't do a blessing over wax. You don't do a blessing over grapes. You do a blessing over something that was created in partnership from what was created on the earth and what humans made from it. So I think that there is something lovely about that idea, whether you believe in God or not, but what can we create together? Or what can we make for ourselves that we need to sustain ourselves or be able to not just have wax, but we need to have light. So how do we turn it into a candle? We can chew on wheat, but let's make it into bread so that we can eat it and be sustained. I like that notion, but what you're talking about here is this lovely empowerment of moving things forward in your life and saying, this is what I think I am and this is what I need. And almost this is what I want to see in myself. I want to see that I can advocate for me and what that does to your self-esteem when you say no or when you say yes. And it really is your yes and really your no.
Exactly. Totally. I think what you're saying is valid too. And so I do support people who want to continue practicing a religion or who want to be atheist or spiritual or something else. There's a lot of possibility here. So I'm not saying you can't believe in a God or a higher power or anything like that, but the way in which we relate to it, I think, matters. So like you're saying, is a more supportive kind of a thing can be helpful. And I think, too, this brings up a good point that for a lot of people, one of the biggest fears about leaving is this existential plunge into nihilism or nothing, or the feeling that that's what it will be. All of a sudden, I went from having this cosmic sense of meaning and purpose and a connectivity where everything I do is connected to a higher purpose. And then it's just me alone fighting a survival battle of evolution against death, in which I ultimately lose. And this can be this total despair, disconnection, nothing matters. I'm alone. And I don't think it has to be the case at all. I don't think that's the only option by any means. In fact, there's ways in which we can really feel our connection to nature and humanity, or if you believe in some kind of spirituality or God, whether through intuition or consciousness expanding practices or rituals or other things that help you connect with a greater sense of support and inspiration that's not just your own egoic thinking. And for me personally, things like meditation and plant medicines and working with expanded states of consciousness really helped me feel that, have a really felt sense I'm not actually isolated, that there's a relationality and flow, finding my fit in life that feels natural to me, that Eastern traditions will refer to this as dharma, this idea of this relational duty or a connection where you're finding your fit and your flow within a greater whole as an organism in an ecosystem. It's not just this isolated thing that can be very helpful.
It's interesting. You use these two words that I think are really beautiful here, this idea of believing in something for support and inspiration. Because I feel like with fundamentalist teachings, with cultic teachings, those are words that elude people, that it is not about something beautiful and relieving and relaxing for support or inspiration. It feels like it's more of the or else. You need to believe this or else there is this anvil hovering over your head. How nice it is to approach spirituality for those reasons and to find that in a tradition or in your own way of interpreting spirituality, whether it's part of a tradition or just what you develop on your own. It just feels healthier, but it also, I'm thinking about just the nervous system, how it gives you a chance to have your nervous system relax. And how nice that must feel. How unusual it must feel at first, but how nice it must feel.
Absolutely. In a lot of fundamentalist groups, they have both. They have that comfort and inspiration, but also all the fear. You have kind of both. And I would say, you know, the fear, all the fear and judgment stuff can really fall away. It's not necessary. It doesn't really serve any purpose.
That's so interesting. And I'm sure it's relieving for people to hear that. So I know we're coming to the end of our time. Was there something else that you wanted to say? And we would love to have you back on to talk about another very pressing subject about manifestation and other sorts of things that you are an expert in. And I would love to be able to talk more about those things with you for another time. But for now, what would you like people to know or to hear before we finish up?
There's so many other things. I also think in terms of fundamentalism is these ideas tend to be dualistic, so have a divinity or spirituality that's separate from the self, that's kind of like a supernatural realm and a natural realm and a spiritual realm and a material realm, a kind of divided experience. So something that I personally have really resonated with in some of the more Eastern or the called non-dual frameworks is this idea that there's really no division anywhere. So there's a non-duality as a philosophy, meaning there's a teaching that the ego or identity is itself kind of an illusion, that the mind creates separate subjects and objects in our experience. So if you look at your experience as if it's a movie screen, you are the whole movie in your experience, not just the visual of your body or the thoughts, stories that you identify with. The idea of a separate self is something of a construct. And so there's a experience of unity or non-separation or flow. What we tend to identify as ourselves isn't actually fundamentally ourselves. I've found these kind of practices that help to kind of expand the sense of self or deconstruct identity to be profoundly helpful. If that sounds too philosophical, I think it doesn't have to be, but just that what we've tended to view as salvation or a divine force outside of us can be more powerfully accessed internally in a lot of ways as resources that we have within our psyche or in our connection to the greater whole that are natural. So a lot of people who leave these traditions have a lot of grief, grieving the death of God, who was their best friend, their comforter, their lover. This massive psychological relationship that feels lost. And I would say that that is an experience that people often have to grieve and process a lot of rage and grief about what they missed out on or what they weren't allowed to do and what got lost. And there is a lot of loss, but that nothing fundamental is lost. That I think a lot of powerful therapies really help people to see that their healing capacities are natural or any capacities that might feel spiritual. They're really close in our experience. There's something that we can reclaim, things like peace or unconditional love or loving kindness, acceptance, transformation, that these are actually more accessible or can be more accessible when you're not looking for it at a distance or being mediated, so to speak.
I love that, right? To not be searching somewhere else for something that might be inside. And to not forget to look inward and to see what you can find, what you can create. That is a really beautiful, reassuring message about the power that we carry around with us already. Thank you so much for coming on the show again and talking about what you experienced, but also what you've learned personally, professionally, spiritually. I look forward to our next conversation about another subject that's going to dovetail this one in some interesting ways, but is also going to take us in a different direction, which will be exciting.
Awesome.
I look forward to that. And thank you so much for today.
Thank you so much for the work you do too. And thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you to Andrew for coming back on the show and talking about some very interesting subjects. And I can't wait for him to be back on to talk about some other subjects that he has in mind to share with us that I am equally interested in. One of the things that Andrew talked about today was this idea that you make things make sense. And I know that's a subject that I've talked a little bit about in the past, but it happens so often that it bears repeating. We want things to make sense. Our brain craves it. We will often also be so happy that we get an answer or that we get a formula to follow that we won't question if the answer is correct. We won't question if that's the right formula. We're just so relieved to have it because then we don't have to worry that we don't have an answer, that we don't have a direction. Then we don't have to feel that same level of stress. So, know that I think almost everyone feels calmed, feels more taken care of, feels like they're going in the right direction when they are given an answer by someone. And sometimes people don't want to question it because they don't want it to be wrong. They're not ready to be in the world again, feeling unmoored and unanchored and without an answer. But it's so important that the answer is the correct one. And know that when we work hard to make sense of things that might not make sense, when we work hard to assume that someone did something to us innocently and they really didn't mean it, we might actually not be holding them accountable for the things that they have done and the things that they might do to us in the future. Know that when we are in something too, it's much harder to take that step away and to notice if something makes sense or not. So that's why I sometimes encourage people, if someone is, let's say, dating someone new and they get this kind of feeling like they're being manipulated, they can't really put their finger on what's wrong about it or what's wrong with the person, but they just get this idea that something feels wrong. They might feel like, well, okay, let me just keep getting together with them and seeing them, and that might solve the problem. Actually, you already probably have enough evidence to know that something is off. And my suggestion is to actually take a step away so that you are not actually drawn back into this person's charm or their spell, where you're going to then have your doubts dispelled. And instead say, I need to take the night to do something else. Or actually, I'm going away this weekend, whether you are or not. And you also don't need to actually come up with a verifiable excuse to not spend time with someone. And if they question you and say, well, where are you going? And when are you going to be back? And how do I know that's where you're going already, that you have enough proof that you shouldn't be with this person? But if you can just take a step away, whether it is in a relationship or even in a new organization that you're involved in, where you feel like you're losing yourself in it, where you feel like things are happening that just don't feel right. But again, you might not know that it is controlling or that it's cultic, because when you're there, everyone seems so happy and they know how to get you enthusiastic about what you're learning. And take a step away. There are a lot of people who were able to get out of a bad situation with a new person they were dating, or were able to actually leave a group they were getting involved in that turned out to be quite toxic when they got sick. Now, it's not saying that you need to go and get sick, but it just happened to be actually during the time of COVID. There are a lot of people who were able to leave because they had that distance. They couldn't actually be under someone's spell as easily. They actually were more physically distanced, and it helped them be more emotionally distanced, where they could take that step away and see things clearly. It's an example that I've given before, and I want to give it again. They will tell you, if you're learning how to photograph things, if you want to do a portrait, you take things from a certain angle. If you want to be able to really zero in on detail, then you need to take things at a certain distance. But if you want to get a sense of the landscape and see the big picture, sometimes you need to take a step back and a step even farther back. And that's how you get to see it all. Take good care, and I will talk to you soon.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Are you healing from manipulation, narcissistic abuse, or coercive control? I created something for you. It's called the Restore Journal app. Built from my decades of experience helping survivors recover, this trauma-informed app is more than journaling. It's a guided healing space to help you process what happened, reconnect with your voice, rebuild self-trust, and create healthier boundaries for the future. You can move at your own pace through all of the sections, and it's a multimedia healing support designed for different learning styles and needs. There are 3 tiers, including one that offers you full access to my video and audio library. If you're ready to feel understood, supported, and move forward with more clarity and strength, the link for the app is in the show notes. Take good care.